This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
First senator outside of Georgia, maybe the first senator, to endorse his candidacy for president. It was an endorsement based on what I believe is Jimmy Carter's enduring attribute, character.
That was U.S. President Joe Biden's eulogy for Jimmy Carter, a man he has known since supporting his 1976 campaign for the presidency. Details coming up. Also, a New York judge today gave Donald Trump an unconditional discharge for a felony conviction. And we also look at how Trump's second term in the White House may affect U.S. relations with Egypt. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Donald Trump will be sworn in January 20th as the only U.S. president with felony convictions. And this week saw a flurry of activity over the court cases still open against him. On Friday, a New York judge sentenced Trump in one of the cases. Trump, who will be sworn in January 20th for his second term in the White House, was given an unconditional discharge, which means the felony conviction stands, but there will be no jail time or fine. The judge said he did not want to interfere with the presidency. Trump and his attorney were not in the courtroom and attended by a video link. He claimed his innocence and called the case a very terrible experience and repeated his claims that he was very, very unfairly treated. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Prasuti brings us the latest.
President-elect Donald Trump had gone through every appeal and even petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to block sentencing in his highest-profile court case. But late Thursday, the High Court rejected his request to delay sentencing. The once-and-future president was found guilty last year of 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide hush money payments to a porn star.
This was a disgrace.
Political analysts like Shannon Beau O'Brien of the University of Texas say this case was personal to Trump.
He doesn't like to admit fault. He doesn't like to admit weaknesses or shortcomings.
New York Supreme Court Judge Juan Merchan, who presided over the trial, had denied a delay, but also said he would not sentence the former president to jail. Gary Rose teaches politics at Sacred Heart University.
I think the message that really is conveyed here is that no one is above the law, and that the process has played out, and it's going to now bring, you know, it's going to bring it to an end.
In a second and third case, a Trump-appointed judge this week temporarily blocked the Justice Department from releasing final reports from special counsel Jack Smith. The cases, both dismissed, involve the storage of classified documents and election interference with the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. This week, the president-elect reiterated his belief that Smith was appointed illegally.
He was thrown off the case in disgrace. Why should he be allowed to write a fake report? It'll only be a fake report.
Special counsels are required to file summary reports. The U.S. Attorney General said he would release Smith's report on the January 6th uprising at the Capitol. Making that public could hamper Trump's efforts to pardon those arrested. Again, Professor O'Brien.
If a lot of this comes to light, that a lot of this was planned and a lot of this, these activities were malicious and they were criminal, he is giving people a free pass on criminal activity.
The fourth case deals with Georgia election interference. The prosecutor was removed due to an improper romantic relationship with an employee. So the case is at a standstill until it is dismissed or until another prosecutor is assigned. Again, Professor Rose.
I think the voters are actually hoping that this whole thing is brought to an end and that now we can begin anew with a second Trump term.
And that term starts on Monday, January 20th.
It feels great.
Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News.
Political observers and commentators are debating how Donald Trump's second stint in the White House will affect U.S. relations with Egypt, which prospered during his first presidential term. Neither President Barack Obama nor Joe Biden invited Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to the White House, while Trump invited him twice. Al-Sisi has said he hopes Trump's second term will provide mutual benefit for both countries and promote peace and stability in the region. Ambassador Ayman Zain el-Din, former director of the media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed al-Shenawi what Trump's re-election could bring to bilateral relations.
First of all, there is a high degree of uncertainty about what the new second presidency of Donald Trump bring to the American policy in general, in different regions, different files, including, of course, that bilateral relations between Egypt and the United States. So there is hope, of course. Every new beginning brings some hope with it, but the amount of uncertainty is affecting that. Let me also say quickly that there is a significant difference between Egyptian-American relations during Trump's first term and this current term. First of all, the issues of a change inside Egypt, democracy, human rights, that kind of thing used to be paramount during the years that preceded and within which President Trump resumed office last time. Those matters have become really very far in the background in international relations and in U.S. foreign policy, not just with Trump, but even with the presidency of outgoing President Biden. So that's one area where change has been dramatic in the context. Also, economic issues in Egypt have changed and have become more complicated compared to where they were a few years ago. But thirdly, and more importantly, most importantly, is what's happening strategically in the region after more than 1 year of war in Gaza, what's happening in Lebanon, Syria, with Iran. The whole regional balance of power has become completely different in a much more dangerous state of affairs compared to where it was. And I have to say, in all honesty, this is how the whole region views it, I guess. It had a lot to do with President Trump, the way he handled the Israeli-Arab conflict, shifting it towards the Abrahamic Accords at the expense of resolving the Palestinian question, in fact, recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the whole of Jerusalem and the annexation of the Golan Heights. So it is a completely different regional context, and this is something that we have to be quite aware of concerning the future of Egyptian-American relations.
With President-elect Trump focus on America first, how would that impact the strategic cooperation between Washington and Cairo?
This is an important question. From the point of view of Egypt, the relations with the United States has always been transactional. Ever since the beginning of quote-unquote peacemaking after the 1973 war. So this transactional nature of relations, basically Egypt delivering on achieving peace and normalization between Israel and Egypt and with the rest of the region, that was the hope at least, America would provide support for Egypt. So that was a transactional relationship in which America first, or what America wants coming first, is not shocking to us if you compare that to the kind of alliance the United States has with Western Europe, with East Asia, countries of East Asia like Japan and Korea, or even with Israel, where the relationship is built on more than just transactional interests. There, the effects of America First policy might have an impact, at least for Europe and Asia. But for Egypt, this is not a shock. This is not something new. Let me tell you how the thinking is in Egypt. I think the question now is not so much what could Trump do to Egypt, but more what can Egypt do to influence Trump in a way that his regional policy would be more constructive to how to make him realize that the current state of affairs is so dangerous, so fraught, that if we continue to see the current trends continue for the next 5 years, we will see a completely changed situation in the region, a very damaging one, where, of course, the interests of the countries of the region will be preeminently affected, but also America's interests will be tremendously affected, because this is a very threatening state of affairs. So this has to be reversed. So this is what is concerning, I think, the thinking in Egypt up in the highest circles of government. This is also an educated speculation and not a whim.
That was Ambassador Ayman Zain el-Din, former director of the media department of the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, speaking with VOA's Mohammed al-Shenawi. 6 days of official funeral ceremonies honoring the life and legacy of U.S. President Jimmy Carter concluded in his home state of Georgia, where VOA's Ken Fabo has more.
In a rare moment uniting all five living presidents, the country said goodbye to the 39th President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, in official state ceremonies at the National Cathedral in Washington. President Joe Biden delivered the eulogy for a man he has known since supporting his 1976 campaign for the presidency.
I was the first senator outside of Georgia, maybe the first senator, to endorse his candidacy for president. It was an endorsement based on what I believe is Jimmy Carter's enduring attribute, character. Character. Character.
The son of President Gerald Ford, Carter's Republican rival for the White House in 1976, also delivered a eulogy his late father wrote to honor his successor.
Honesty and truth-telling were synonymous with the name Jimmy Carter.
Jason Carter paid tribute to his grandfather's legacy as the founder of the nonprofit Carter Center, which fights disease, builds hope, and wages peace around the world.
Essentially, he eradicated a disease with love and respect. He waged peace with love and respect. He led this nation with love and respect.
A somber day that began in Washington ended in Carter's home state of Georgia, which welcomed him back on a final journey home to the town of Plains.
Because this little town shaped him.
Dot Padgett, who worked on Jimmy Carter's Peanut Brigade of volunteers in his 1976 campaign for the White House, joined hundreds lining the streets of Plains to say goodbye to the man who was more than a former president to them.
I've spent a lot of time with Rosen and Jimmy in this town, and I am so grateful that at this date and this time that I can be back and be with the family.
President Carter put Plains in the spotlight for most of his life, and his final journey through the town he called home for a century attracted media and visitors from around the world.
It is a sad occasion, and America and the world will be less well off because of the passing of Jimmy Carter.
Former member of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, Sir Simon Burns, traveled from England to say goodbye to his friend, Jimmy Carter.
I think as the casket passed, the finality of the situation really struck home. This was the last time we were going to see President Carter.
Following a private funeral service at Maranatha Baptist Church, Jimmy Carter's hearse made one last procession through Plains, taking his casket to the edge of town, to the modest home he and Rosalind built in the 1960s, the place they called home after leaving the White House, and where they are reunited under a willow tree near the pond they fished in for much of their post-presidential life. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Plains, Georgia.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. I'm your host, Yehias Wuhib, in Washington. In part two of my conversation with Mutuki Mumo, Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, she talks about how journalists and media freedom are under duress in multiple African countries, with journalists arbitrarily arrested and imprisoned. I started by asking her if internet shutdowns stifle press freedom in Africa.
Thank you so much for this question. It's an incredibly important question. What we've seen increasingly in, not just in Africa, but I think it's a global trend, is that moments of political tension, moments of political crisis, are increasingly accompanied by disruptions of not just the internet, but telecommunications in general, disruptions of the systems that people need to keep themselves informed. You are cut off from the channels that you need to communicate with in order to know what's happening in your neighborhood, what's happening in your own country. You are cut off from the information that you need to make decisions. And on the other side, if you're a journalist, you're cut off from reliable, credible, safe ways to communicate with your sources. You're cut off from being able to disseminate the news quickly. So you can only imagine the kind of information blackout that someone in that environment faces. And it has repercussions on the ability of people to make the choices that they need to make about their own safety. It has repercussions on the ability of journalists to keep the public informed. And this is a really a trend that we need to leave behind in 2024.
As the Africa Program Coordinator for CPJ, your thoughts on human rights situations in West African countries affected by political instability and insecurity, such as in Nigeria?
Nigeria has its own unique situation and its own unique challenges. It's a country that has been a grave concern for CPJ for a while. And it's a country where really, given the diversity of the media, that should be doing better, that should be doing much, much better and should be setting the example for many other countries in the region. And so what we've seen, the kind of trends that we've seen in Nigeria are during moments of political instability, we've seen journalists being targeted. What comes to mind is in 2024, during protests, where CPJ documented at least 56 journalists facing attacks and harassment, you know, while they were covering cost of living protests in August.
A situation as far as journalists are concerned in Somalia?
It's something that is often repeated, that Somalia remains one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist in Africa. Unfortunately, the trends of 2024 do not suggest a change to this. While we at CPJ did not document the killing of a journalist in 2024 in Somalia in connection to their work, the cases of the numerous others who've been killed since CPJ started keeping track of this data in 1992 remain largely unresolved.
In neighboring Ethiopia, lots of political upheaval going on in that country. How is it faring as far as press freedom is concerned?
For a while, I would say for the last 5 years, we've been documenting arbitrary detention as a form of press freedom violation. 2024 was not an exception. We continue to see Ethiopian journalists being detained. What we found is that our records showed that at least 54 Ethiopian journalists and media workers had been forced to exile.
And Mutuki, let's conclude our conversation with what's going on in your neck of the woods, Kenya.
In Nairobi, I am very worried about the status of freedom of expression and freedom of speech in this country. Now, we noted at CPJ that during protests in 2024, journalists faced physical attacks from security personnel. Some of them were briefly detained. We are really aware that this is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the challenges that the media faces in Kenya. If we were to sort of do an assessment of the Ruto presidency, the presidency of William Ruto, I would say we've seen really drastic violations of press freedom.
That was Mutuki Mumo, the Africa Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. She spoke to me from Nairobi. And in our sports roundup, we have a VOA sports analyst, Mokbilia Baro, in studio. Thank you for joining us, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
And in some football news, different competitions across club teams in Europe. Can you tell us more?
Absolutely. So if we're just going to kick it off with the EFL Cup, the Carabao Cup, Arsenal played Newcastle on Tuesday, losing at home 2-0. This is the semifinals. So currently, both of them have two legs. They play home and away. There is no specific goal like there was once upon a time. But 2-0 losing to Newcastle is a huge defeat for Arsenal. Them having to potentially tie that result and then go into penalties is going to be very difficult in Newcastle's home field, St. James Park. Also, Liverpool versus Tottenham, that game happened on Wednesday. Tottenham Hotspurs were able to defeat Liverpool 1-0, interestingly enough, but Liverpool at home in Anfield is going to be a tough task for them. So, they have their hands full as well. The next games will be held on February 5th and February 6th alike. Also, for the FA Cup, few of the games that were played for the third round, Fulham defeated Watford 4-1. Sheffield United defeated Cardiff City 1-0. But the main game that everyone's kind of looking forward to is the clash between Manchester United and Arsenal on Sunday. That'll be a big clash. Other than that, there's some Premier League teams playing other lower level championship teams.
And the two hottest teams in the NBA clashed on Wednesday. Is that a fair assessment to say? How did the game go?
Absolutely, Hayes. The Oklahoma City Thunder and the Cleveland Cavaliers are both number one seeds in the Eastern and Western Conference, respectively. The Cleveland Cavaliers were able to win 129-122, snapping a 15-game win streak for the Thunder. This would be a very exciting NBA Finals, two very young teams, teams that were developed the correct way through the general managers going out and drafting correctly, putting this team together. It wasn't like they went and bought $100 million players and put a super team together. No, this is the old-fashioned way, putting together teams. You draft correctly and get it done. So it's really nice to see teams like that now starting to kind of take over the league.
And finally, Mokbil, the Australian Open will be starting this Saturday. Who are the favorites on the men's and women's sides?
Absolutely, Hayes. On the men's side, you know, anytime Djokovic is playing in any competition, he's still one of the favorites. If we're looking at the Australian Open men's odds, Jannik Sinner, world number one, is obviously ranked at the number one position. His odds are plus 130. Carlos Alcaraz, who also has been on form, is in second with Novak Djokovic, as we just mentioned. And Alexander Zverev is third. And lastly, Daniil Medvedev is also, you know, usual. We call these guys the usual suspects. And, you know, we can hopefully expect my man Big TFO to do well, as well as he had a heck of a 2024. On the women's side, if we're looking at it, Coco Gauff for sure has to be in that conversation, as well as Arna Sabalenka, who is the world number one on the women's side as well. And lastly, Elena Rybakina will be last but not least on that list. That looks like the Australian Open to me.
VOA sports analyst Mokbil Yabaro, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.